This is Hap May with the Legal Play. Today we're going to talk about earnest money contracts, in particular earnest money contracts to buy real estate. Typically, a lot of people will know about this because they have bought or sold homes using a form with a realtor or perhaps a lawyer had drafted for them and used that to negotiate. There are also forms not just for houses, but for farms and ranches and commercial office buildings and other commercial properties, industrial properties, all of which there are forms that are promulgated, although somebody could, and in very complicated cases, sometimes just have a lawyer draft one from scratch in the process. But most people use forms promulgated by the Texas Real Estate Commission. I think there's some realtor groups that also promulgate some forms, and there are some legal groups that have come up with lawyer forms and bar associations and things like that. Typically, though, most people will recognize the 1-to-4 family residential contract, which I will use as the example in my talk today. This is a form promulgated by the Texas Real Estate Commission, which is a state government agency that attempts to draft or come up with a form that takes into account most of the issues that will come up in the course of the sale of a residential property. Again, there are also forms for commercial and industrial that try to do the same things. Those are sometimes more complicated. In this form, though, they will have a process where they identify the seller and the buyer, and identify the property by, you know, some sort of description. For most houses, there is a lot, block, subdivision, county, and a reference to a county filing or a plat that clearly identifies a property. In some different cases, there may be a survey or a meets and bounds description, which usually becomes an exhibit, typically Exhibit A, to an earnest money contract that describes more definitely what the property is. There's a description of what the sales price is, whether there's going to be any financing associated with that, whether there are any leasing provisions, either maybe there's a tenant there, part of the property is leased, or the seller is going to need to have some time to get out. So there's a whole set of documents that allow that to be leased back for a day or a month or some other period in time. If that period of time gets to be too long, there can be problems that are created. There are some situations where a buyer will lease from a seller before the closing. For a number of reasons, we don't advise that, because if the buyer becomes in possession or gets in possession of the property and doesn't buy the property, something falls through on the foreclosure, it could be difficult for the person who thought he was going to be a seller to get that person evicted. So we generally, as lawyers, try to advise people not to do that. Typically, there will be a earnest money put down, which is a check which is usually paid to a title company to hold until the transaction either terminates or is fulfilled and there's a closing and the buyer actually buys, in which case the earnest money is credited. Generally speaking, there are forfeiture provisions that if certain things do not happen and the property does not close, the buyer is at risk of losing that earnest money. In modern times, or in recent years, they've developed a termination option where a buyer will pay a fixed amount of money in markets that, you know, are what we call buyer's market, where there's a lot of product available. That's usually a low number. Sometimes that's $100 or $200 or $500, where the buyer has the option to say, okay, for you know, no reason, you know, or just I don't want to, I've changed my mind, or I saw something in an inspection I didn't like, and I'm terminating. And I'm going to forfeit my termination fee, whether that's $100 or $500, and you can keep that, but I get the rest of my earnest money back. Today, we've got a much tighter market where there's not a lot of product out there. So some of these termination provisions, there's a much higher number that the buyers are putting up in order to attract sellers, or even a waiver in some cases of the termination option, which makes a buyer a little more competitive. And so if a seller has five different people bidding on the property, the one that doesn't want a termination option or puts up a $5,000, you know, termination option number, may be more likely to have a seller accept a contract. Almost always, although I can name examples where it doesn't happen, but almost always the title company or title insurance company gets involved in the process. And the purpose of a title insurance company is, one, to go through the process to make sure that the seller has good title, there are no liens, and the borders are properly defined, and there are no easements or judgments, again, liens that affect the property, so that the buyer knows that he's actually buying, you know, the property, and there are not going to be any legal problems that come up afterward. And if there are legal problems that come up afterward, there is an insurance policy that will help pay the cost of fixing that problem or pay the damages caused by the title problem in there. And there's a number of cases I've handled where we've dealt with disputes where title companies came in and defended and paid. Usually the seller pays for the title policy, but there's a box on the form and the buyer can pay for it. And in maybe 2% of the cases I've handled in my life, the buyer actually did pay for the title policy. The title company generally takes over the process of closing. They will get a title report out showing what liens or easements or problems there are that exist, and whether they get eliminated or it's just something that a buyer has to understand, that the utility company has an easement to bring water and sewer and electricity and gas into the house. So the title company will give that report and work out whatever needs to be worked out with regard to that, make sure that any liens or taxes or homeowners association dues that are due are paid at closing. And generally speaking, the money goes to the title company that then pays, or the buyer's money, whether that actually comes from a buyer or a buyer's lender, goes into the title company. The title company will pay the taxes, pay the former mortgage company, pay any other liens necessary to clean it up, and disperse the excess monies, if any, to the seller. And there are some cases where prices have not gone up, and the sellers have to come to the table with money in order to sell the property. But that's the role a title company plays. Generally speaking, in the process of buying a home, there will be a survey done. And again, in cases where there are lots and blocks in a subdivision, that's usually not that difficult to do. In cases where you have a farm or a ranch or larger sorts of acreage, that can be an issue. Sometimes you get subdivisions or a subdivision where somebody has a big lot, they divide it into two lots, and a survey becomes important. There are also inspections where the buyer will send an inspector in to make sure that the plumbing works and the foundation is good and the roof is good and there aren't any you know, mechanical or physical problems with the home. And there are reports, the survey report and an inspection report. And generally speaking, the buyer has an opportunity to object to those things and either have some allowance to fix something or require a seller to fix something before closing, and to look at the survey to figure out if they're getting what they want, or maybe if an old easement needs to get released, or some border with the neighbor needs to be defined because the fence is not quite on the borderline, and deal with issues like those. Once those objections are resolved and financing is set up, the title company can conduct a closing. Of course, lenders, the buyer's lender, which most home purchases, not all but most, involve a mortgage company or a bank or some third-party lender lending a borrower money, and the lender will want to have a valid first lien on the property. So the mortgage company will get involved and look at the survey and look at the title report and make sure that they're getting a clean first lien on a property that's going to have value. They're also doing appraisal to make sure the property is worth enough to support the loan. And sometimes you get into problem with appraisal, not recently because values have gone up, but in tighter markets, you can have a contract for a $300,000 house and it only appraises for $280,000, and then all of a sudden the availability of a down payment and the loan to value ratio, the borrower may not be able to actually close. There are provisions in contracts that can give a buyer the option to get out of a contract if they don't meet the financial requirements. In this market, some buyers are waiving that, and that's just a point of negotiation as to whether or not the buyer can get out if the buyer does not qualify. Also, if the property doesn't appraise for the right value. The closing date is an important provision in an earnest money contract. It, generally speaking, will set the date at which the buyer must buy or be in default of the contract. Sometimes there are extensions granted voluntarily if it's inspections taking too long or there's some other reason that you can't close that way, but everybody still wants to get the deal done. There are forms that realtors will pass around to the buyers and sellers to extend that date. But ultimately, there is a date at which the transaction needs to take place or the buyer will be in default. Or if in the case where a buyer shows up and is willing to do that and the seller for some reason doesn't, wants to back out of the deal, the seller could be in default. After the closing takes place, the buyer will turn possession over to the seller. Generally, that's basically giving them the keys and having the seller move their stuff out of there if they haven't already moved out already. Sometimes it's more complicated than that. You may have a tenant. I've seen cases recently where the seller is an executor of the estate and the seller's brother is still in the property, and it problems create when the brother won't move his stuff out. And there are, you know, situations where that occurs, where a seller sells the property and then doesn't move out. An earnest money contract is, if done properly, an enforceable contract. And there are lawsuits, although very few house transactions actually wind up in litigation. Some of them do. And of course, in my career, I've probably handled 20, 25 cases that involve with a default on an earnest money contract. And it is a, you know, lawsuit. It ties up the property. It can get expensive. Generally speaking, it is difficult for a seller to enforce a contract against a buyer just because you can sue them for damages. The damages are generally what it costs you, is what it costs the seller to find a new buyer, the difference in price, and the carrying cost of the property going forward. But even if you get a judgment against a potential buyer, that judgment may or may not be collectible. Generally speaking, these things fall out because the buyer didn't have enough money to do the deal. And if he didn't have enough money to do the deal, he probably doesn't have enough money to pay a judgment on a lawsuit. However, there are situations where we have a wealthy enough of buyer that should be willing to pay some money to get out of the contract, and would be have some problems with having a lawsuit and getting a judgment against them that may want them to pay some sort of compensation to the seller for the seller's loss in connection with a broken earnest money contract. On the flip side, though, a buyer who wants to enforce a contract against a seller that wrongfully backs out of a contract, there are good remedies. The seller has the property. A lawsuit can be filed, and some Latin term known as a lis pendens be filed in the real property records, which basically what that is, puts the world on notice that title to this property is a subject matter of a lawsuit. And whoever buys the property from the seller is taking it subject to the rights of the lis pendens holder or the potential buyer in our example. I have had situations where I represented a buyer who sued under breach of an earnest money contract. It actually went to trial. And with attorney's fees and costs and other damages, the buyer wound up with a judgment larger than the purchase price on the earnest money contract, which resulted in the seller getting absolutely nothing and still losing their house because they defaulted on an earnest money contract and required the buyer to go through the legal process, which was expensive. One caveat to the notion that a buyer can sue a seller and recover something is that if the seller has a large mortgage on the property, then there may not be much the seller can do because the mortgage company likely would foreclose on the property, wiping out the interest the seller had, leaving not much for a buyer to collect from the seller. And this happens a lot of times in earnest money cases where the seller has mortgages that exceed the value of the house, and when they get to closing, they realize they have to write a big check in order to close that, and maybe they don't want to, or maybe they can't do that. So sometimes you can negotiate a short sale where the mortgage company will accept less and let the buyer go through. Other times you can't do that, and the deal just goes bust, and the buyer is not left with a good remedy with regard to that. So that's my quick discussion of earnest money contracts, and hope that the listeners here glean something from this. Many people might have thought this is a simple process. In a number of cases, it is. It goes smoothly. But like any area of the law or any financial transaction, there are all kinds of things that can make it complicated and go wrong. And sometimes you need legal help in order to protect everybody's rights. And in some cases, save a transaction that would otherwise not occur. This is Hap May with Legal Play, and we'll be back with more.